Welcome now to another program from your North Carolina Reading Service. This show intended for our audience of blind and print impaired listeners. I'm John Feddersen, reading the Indie Week, the Independent to You, a weekly journal of news and bulletins and information, entertainment. This issue dated August the 29th of 2024. And we'll just make this announcement that after this broadcast, which is to take place on Friday the 30th, this show goes into the can in our podcast section. Indie Week, here we go. All right, well done on that from our musicians. And this issue, except for a few cultural articles, seems to be determined almost entirely to the city of Durham. And so I will get to it right now. All right, and first, Duke encounters mistrust at City Hall with the recent rezoning requests. Last week, a city council discussion about a rezoning request took a bizarre turn. Mayor Pro Tem Mark Anthony Middleton, borrowing a quip from the comedian Chris Rock to describe a town and gown connection: "It's like your uncle who paid for you to go to college but molested you. It's a difficult relationship." Middleton's comments came as lawyers for Duke petitioned the council to rezone chunks of the campus to the city's University and College UC designation. That unique zoning, which already applies to most of Duke's campus, allows the university to build essentially whatever it wants without having to go back through the lengthy council approval process for developers. While Duke has owned many of the parcels in question for years, the university's lawyers said the rezoning would help with future campus-wide planning. The council, reluctant to provide that blank check rezoning for Duke without more details, decided to postpone the vote until their October 7th meeting and requested that Duke's lawyers come back with a more detailed plan for development for those parcels. That hearing marked the second time this year that Duke's rezoning requests have run into skepticism at City Hall. The August rezoning request was only the second half of a two-part bundle that had originally included several parcels in the Birch Avenue neighborhood. Duke withdrew those requests after the Planning Commission at an April meeting recommended the council deny them. The Planning Commission, however, did recommend that the City Council approve the request that landed before it in August. At both meetings, officials pushed for more details from Duke. In April, Birch Avenue residents questioned what Duke would build on sites like the old laundry building on Gattis Street that are in the middle of narrow residential roads. Russell Lacey, who lives in the Birch Area Avenue neighborhood, told Indy at the time, "We made three specific requests of things we wanted Duke to exclude from the list of possible developments: a parking deck, a bus depot, and a sewage and wastewater treatment plant." At the August 19 meeting, council member Javier Caballero specifically worried the university could obstruct city plans to build a 10-foot-wide pedestrian and bike path near Duke Hospital, while Councilmember Carl Rist questioned the lack of sustainability commitments, especially given Duke's recent climate commitment. Caballero said the rezoning makes sense from just a land use perspective, but we all know that Duke has not also been the best actor sometimes. And so there is community distrust, and there's certainly distrust on this council. Neil Gosch, attorney representing Duke for Morningstar Law Group and who previously had served on the Planning Commission, argued that such conversations could take place when the university actually began developing the areas and the Duke couldn't provide plans, quote, because they literally do not have plans yet. Ghosh had made similar arguments before the April meeting. That vagueness clearly frustrated Councilmember Chelsea Cook. Cook says there will be no enforcement mechanism at that time once the zoning has changed. You're asking us to make a change without having any idea what the plan is. Middleton, however, said while he has his fair share of beef with Duke, he was not going to, quote, use the particularities of this case as a cudgel, saying, I mean, it's a university. They're not going to build a strip club. I don't see how that's going to forward their mission. Now, the biggest article in this issue of Indie Week concerns the Durham School of the Arts price tag. And this is dwarfing its peers at a cost of approximately $250 million. The new Durham School of the Arts will be the most expensive public middle or high school built in the Triangle area, likely in the state, says an analysis by the Ninth Street Journal. The new school's base price is an estimated $240 million. That's $643 per square foot, according to Durham Public Schools. The cost is higher still, $256 million, when additional items like athletic fields are included. That's far more than most comparable North Carolina school construction projects. The school board voted last Thursday to approve on the proposal to move the School of the Arts to a new campus rather than renovate the current site. The item was placed on yesterday evening's consent agenda after action was postponed on an August 8th meeting. The school district defends the project's cost. Frederick Davis, DPS Senior Executive Director of Building Services, said in an email response, DSA is currently in line with estimates and budget numbers based on programming and market conditions. Construction continues to become increasingly expensive due to market conditions and current construction inflation. Construction costs certainly have risen in recent years. A North Carolina Department of Public Instruction report found that in 2020, the average construction cost for North Carolina schools was approximately $250 per square foot. Based on the report, the state's most expensive school project as of 2020 was Fuller Elementary School in Wake County at a cost of nearly $300 per square foot. The state report only includes projects through the fall of 2021. At that time, North Carolina's most expensive high school came at $288 per square foot. Even given rising costs, though, the price tag for the new DSA is lofty. While some recent school projects have topped $400 per square foot, and two recent North Carolina projects, one in Wake and one in Charlotte, cost more than $500 a square foot, most budgets for construction are less than DSA's estimated cost, $643 per square foot. DSA has been the subject of fiery back and forth between the district and the community, with some community members advocating for renovating the current DSA at its downtown site rather than building a new school. The group Durham for DSA created a counter proposal, a renovation plan for the current site that groups says will cost approximately $180 million. Given the controversy, the Ninth Street Journal, that is the publication that cooperates with Indie Week for joint articles, compared DSA's price tag with other North Carolina school construction projects. Seeking information on costs of middle and high school projects since 2020. The state data is scant, though, after 2020. To find more current information, we contacted school districts in the Triangle and surrounding areas, as well as two major metropolitan areas, Charlotte and Greensboro. In the greater Triangle area, we contacted Wake County, Chapel Hill, Orange County, Johnston, and Chatham County schools. Also, many nearby Guilford County schools and Alamance, Burlington. Finally, we reached out to Charlotte Mecklenburg, which recently passed a $2.5 billion bond referendum for school construction. We also consulted government documents, local news coverage, and sites of contracted architectural firms. And we will continue to update our findings as new information becomes available. While a perfect one-to-one comparison is not possible, the new DSA stands out among recent and current projects for its total cost and per square footage cost. I'm going to add in here, folks, that this article included a couple of significant graphs and charts, which I'm unable to describe for you. Comparison for price in various categories from these competitive or recently contacted districts. And some of them are incompletely reported, so it would be more or less a waste of time. However, those interested could go to IndyWeek.com, IndyWeek.com, and find this article with its accompanying charts if interested. The district, though, emphasizes DSA is a specialized arts school which comes with special costs. Davis said it's a comprehensive middle and high with additional programming for the arts. In a presentation to the board, administration showcased other districts with similar estimates and budget for comprehensive high schools. Back in 2023, Calvin Stevens, a consultant from CATE Service and Construction, presented the school board with a slide comparing costs for the new DSA with school projects in Wake and Charlotte. Only two listed projects included square footage costs, though. And one of those figures is now out of date. The Wake County projects include Felton Grove High and Parkside Middle, Wake Early College of Information and Biotechnology, listed on the DPS presentation as H-12 and M-19 Middle and High School. Wake County School confirmed H-12 refers to Felton Grove, M-19 refers to Parkside and Wake Early College. Plans, though, for Parkside Wake are in flux. A community meeting tonight will consider a plan to flip the construction sites, which will reduce costs. Wake's new Felton Grove will accommodate 2,200 students, similar to DSA's target enrollment of 2,200. Despite the two schools' similar enrollments, Felton Grove will cost $540 per square foot, compared with the $643 for the new DSA. And there are other comparable presentations which, as I said, do not respond with complete figures. Not included is a Charlotte Mecklenburg project to create a trio of magnet art schools. That plan entails converting Northwest School of the Arts into an arts high school, and First Ward into an arts middle school. A third school, an elementary school with a separate construction budget, will share the arts focus, with middle and high school renovations totaling about $93, $94 million. Northwest School of the Arts First Ward will cost $300 per square foot, less than half of DSA's $643. While providing a specialized arts education for students in grades 6 through 12. Guilford County is also creating a specialized arts school, but with a more modest budget. Their plan to renovate Swan Middle School into an arts school for 6 through 12 at a cost of $78 million is currently in its design phase. Unlike Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and Guilford, DPS will likely move forward with new construction rather than renovation. While board members and community advocates have asked for more clarity on costs of building versus renovating the current site, all board members indicated support for the new school at the August 8th meeting. District officials have said that renovating the current DSA would be more costly than building a new school. A study presented in August based on data from CATE, found renovating the current school would cost about $270 million. Community members have questioned the methodology used to calculate that cost. Funding for DSA comes from a $420 million bond referendum, which was passed in 2022. At a cost of at least $240 million, the new DSA will consume over half the bond amount. And as a result, renovations have been delayed at several local elementary schools. John Hodges Couple, a member of Durham for DSA, and a retired planning director, said he was not surprised to learn that building a new DSA is so pricey. Quote, "Your findings confirm that building a fancy DSA in North Durham instead of transforming the downtown campus will require sweeping funding away from elementary schools that voters supported in 2022. Maybe that's what Durham wants, but why not ask the community which they prefer? That seems more like the Durham way of doing things." As I said, plenty of Durham today, and this article published on the 28th of August by Justin Laidlaw says that local nonprofits are collaborating on opportunities for Durham youth. These local nonprofits are teaming up with the mayor, Leonardo Williams, to help foster more youth opportunities in Durham. On August 15th, during a press conference with Boys and Girls Club of Durham and Orange Counties, Williams announced the Bull City Future Fund, a privately funded initiative that aims to provide overstressed youth programs with supportive resources. He said this fund is about creating a community and culture in which helping one another build a better, safer community for our future, our children, is a reality for all of us. United Way of the Greater Triangle will lead this initiative with support from the Triangle Community Foundation. Erica Gukian, United Way of Greater Triangle president and CEO, kicked off remarks with an impassioned speech about the need for the fund. Gukian said, "This is a big deal for our community here in Durham. This mayor is doing amazing work and shows amazing vision to know that this is all our youth need to be safe, seen, and celebrated. We will not rest until every one of our kids has that. This is a God-given right." Jeff Howell, chief program officer for the United Way, says the project has been in the works for months, but the idea stems from a decades-long relationship between Howell and Williams. The two taught at Southern High School in the early 2010s and have kept in touch, hoping to one day collaborate together outside of the classroom. Howell says United Way has the trust and community relationships with nonprofits to maximize that partnership, and working outside the bureaucracy of government will allow funding to reach nonprofits more quickly. Howell tells Indy, "When Leo and I were talking, it was a lot of how can we leverage his current position as mayor and also his spotlight within the Democratic Party. He's getting a lot of attention right now with United Way to support nonprofits who are doing the on-the-ground work." United Way has stepped up to answer the call when communities are hit by unforeseen circumstances. In 2019, following a gas explosion in downtown Durham that killed two people, United Way partnered with Triangle Community Foundation to create the Durham One Fund to raise money for residents and businesses that the blast had impacted. Months later, January of 2020, the same United Way and TCF partnership provided more than $50,000 to McDougal Terrace residents who were evacuated due to high levels of carbon monoxide and mold. Gukian says the organization, through Howell's leadership, better understood how to best serve the community's need through this experience. Quote, "I was getting calls from various corporations saying, hey, we want to help. We'll give you money for this and that. And Jeff was like, we need to go to McDougal Terrace and ask them what they need. That ethos seems simple, but it's not the way philanthropy works. It's generally like I get a call or people in power get a call, then they react to it. Durham has no shortage of nonprofits, but often the individual groups lack resources to scale their operation. Howell says they want to invest in programs with a proven track record instead of supporting folks who want to build something from scratch. Howell says folks that have been doing this work for a while need resources to expand what works. What we want to do is give enough money to where they can hire another staff person, increasing hours they've been operating services or the number of people to show they can ramp up to go get other funding. Crime still plagues sectors of Durham, especially among young people. Calls for safe, accessible, alternative outlets for Durham's youth have echoed throughout the city. Williams is a vocal advocate for mentorship programs and recreational activities, and he's not alone. The city council is unified on ensuring Durham's youth have their needs met. Councilmember Nate Baker told the Indy last December, we need to make sure that young people never have a moment where they don't have any options for things to do. They need real, legitimate choices for fun and stimulating activities that are close to where they live all year long. We can make sure that's a goal. Many Triangle youth programs were significantly downsized or eliminated during the pandemic. In response, United Way has contributed over $30 million to local nonprofits across Orange, Wake, Durham, and Johnston counties to support youth and families. The group aims to raise $1 million in its first round of funding for the Mayor's Youth Initiative, Howell says. If you go downtown, there isn't much for young people. You can't go to the mall anymore if you're under 18 by yourself, or wander around town. You can't go into an arcade. So how are we supporting both educational pieces, but also letting kids have a safe space? And my pile of Durham articles now comes to a close with this one. Breastfeed Durham installs welcome signs in local parks. Love Anderson wants to normalize and encourage breastfeeding in Durham's public spaces. That's why illustrated breastfeeding welcome signs are popping up in the city's parks. Anderson, the chief operating officer of the health equity advocacy group Breastfeed Durham, came up with the idea based on her own experiences breastfeeding her two sons. The project is a collaboration between Breastfeed Durham and Durham Parks and Rec. Anderson says, I was nursing my two that were born a little too close together. You have a lot of breasts out when you're tandem nursing. I was often asked to cover up or move, and a lot of people made comments that made me feel like it had something to do with being brown. It happened a lot in Durham parks, where you think we're in this liberal city. We're in the city of medicine. Breast milk has proven health benefits, but social stigma surrounding breastfeeding outside the home can dissuade families from doing it, according to the National Institutes of Health. Breastfeed Durham wants to create intentional spaces for families to breastfeed comfortably and break down that stigma. The group commissioned J. Jamal Walton, a local comic creator and pop artist who has created art for Go Durham and Discover Durham, to do digital illustrations for the signs. Walton's six illustrations celebrate diversity of people and families who breastfeed. Anderson says the images are based on research on the different reasons families are asked to cover up or move when breastfeeding. They're all based in discrimination. People don't like your race. People perceive you as being the wrong income, the wrong citizenship, not female enough. Too much areola is showing. Walton's first illustration shows a person with a single mastectomy breastfeeding their baby with their partner at their side. Walton says progressively they just got more and more inclusive, pushing the boundaries more. The only real feedback I got was, can we get more areola? The illustrations show breastfeeding parents across the spectrum of race and gender expression. One smiles blissfully as she breastfeeds her baby. Another appears tired but determined. Each illustration reads, breastfeeding welcome and lactancia bienvenida, the Spanish translation. Breastfeed Durham and DPR plan to install 40 signs across Durham's public parks in the coming weeks, says Anderson. So far, 17 have been installed. Breastfeed Durham wants to make sure all families in Durham, but particularly Black and marginalized families, have access to resources and support around breastfeeding. Anderson describes breast milk as a great equalizer for all the health benefits it delivers. Excellent nutrition, immune support, and protection from heart disease and certain cancers later in life. She and Breastfeed Durham see expanding access to breastfeeding as one way to lower racial health disparities in Durham County, beginning with disproportionately high infant mortality rates for Black babies. In 2017, the county's Black infant mortality rate was nearly 12%, compared to 3.8% for white infants. Now, that statistic mirrors state and nationwide disparities. Anderson says, not only are we lowering infant mortality, we're lowering the racial disparity, and there's not a lot of things that do that. Breastfeed Durham shares a slate of breastfeeding resources online, sets up lactation spaces in local business to make them breastfeeding friendly, and convenes culture and identity-based affinity groups of breastfeeding parents. I'm going to insert here that many of these statements in the Indie Week article have links associated with them. Breastfeeding resources online is one of them, and clicking that one would take one to a list compiled, I guess, by Indie Week of these online resources. Mary Unterreiner, DPR's public information and communication manager, says the city is getting good feedback about the new signs. Quote, people are really responding to it. They're beautiful pieces. And people connect with the image, the concept. Everyone should feel included and welcome welcome and comfortable feeding their children. Breastfeed Durham is piloting this project and analogous groups in 20 other cities and want to replicate it, according to Anderson. Quote, everybody keeps saying, can we use your art? Do we have the rights to share? We do. Should you use them? I would say no, because this represents our city. The artworks were created to be Durham-specific, explains Walton. Each one features a hidden bull motif and the red, yellow, and blue shades and seven stars of Durham's city flag. Anderson says, art is everywhere in Durham, and we wanted art that looks like Durham. All right, to Raleigh, or at least not Raleigh, the entire state of North Carolina. Andrea Richards' article, which came out on August 20th, in a new podcast, North Carolina Debutantes Take Their Gloves Off. Weird, she writes, is a word that's been getting a lot of mileage lately, but try this on for size. A Raleigh-based secret society comprising 21 to 35-year-old white men, has unknown agents scouring the state of North Carolina every year to find young women from wealthy families. These women are then culled using vague, largely legacy-based criteria into a selective invite list for an expensive ritual that involves a series of parties, a personalized stool, and final induction ceremony. The chosen young women, all of whom are 19 years old and white, with one known exception. The first black woman to participate was in 2017, almost a century after the event's founding. They don wedding dresses and often white gloves, symbolizing their purity and refinement for the grand event, a moment where they are presented on stage to an assembled crowd, each woman accompanied by her father, who is given a military title for the occasion. This is the strange ritual of coming out at the North Carolina Debutante Ball, an annual event held in Raleigh since 1923 and the only remaining statewide debutante ball in the United States. Out now, Recovering Debs, a new limited episode podcast, explores the experiences of women who have participated in North Carolina debutante culture. Podcast host Mary Lambeth Moore, who lives in Raleigh and is the author of the novel Sleeping with Patty Hearst, is a debutante herself. She hadn't thought much about her own 1970 debut at the statewide ball, she says, until she began working on a memoir. The writing process led Moore to revisit her experience, which left lingering questions, both about her participation and debutante culture itself. She says of her questions behind the podcast, which made its own debut this summer, why does this event, which is rooted in sexism, racism, and classism, still exist? How do the young women who are debutantes feel about it today, and who is really benefiting from this? The podcast began with my curiosity about these questions, and I feel like I'm beginning to get some answers. Recovering Debs begins with the story of Lisa Grabarek, another debutante and the daughter of Wentz Grabarek, who served as Durham's mayor from 1963 to 1971. Beloved as a public figure who helped the city voluntarily desegregate during the civil rights movement, Wentz Grabarek spent much of his long life, he lived to be 100, bringing together the city's black and white leaders, businesses, and communities. Listening to his daughter's debut story, it's hard to reconcile her father's public work for equality with his desperate desire for her to participate in an event she objected to because of its exclusionary nature. It's even harder to stomach the tactics by which her parents coerce her into participating. Without spoiling the episode, Lisa Grabarek's debut becomes a matter of life and death, or at least one manipulated to seem as if it is. Lisa's story leaves listeners wondering, what kind of power do these debutantes ball hold that they can sway even a man of Wentz Grabarek's moral certitude? Many cultures around the world celebrate a young woman's coming of age with community celebrations, from quinceañeras and bat mitzvahs to sweet 16s and Filipino debuts. Black cotillion culture includes debutante balls as well, several of which are held in North Carolina. And there are plenty of debutante balls outside of Raleigh's statewide ball. Many cities have their own smaller balls, such as the one in Durham that Lisa Grabarek describes. But these events all differ from the statewide ball in many ways, and the specificity of this event is what Moore investigates in the rest of what she plans to be an 8-part series. Quote, I understand that some women love making their debut and they have a great time, But one thing I've learned is that when we're talking about the statewide ball, many people, especially the debutantes themselves, don't know a lot of what is behind it. The colonialist origins harken back to England, wherein wealthy families married off their daughters by presenting them to society. The state ball, whether or not it has integrated itself, and evidence suggests it barely has, remains tied to this legacy of colonialism and white supremacy in numerous ways. Moore points out, for instance, there's always been a higher number of debutantes from eastern North Carolina, the part of the state where the largest population of enslavers were, too. The driving power behind this statewide ball is a group called the Terpsichorean Club, quote, comprised of young gentlemen from the Raleigh area, according to wording repeated in several articles about the ball from the conservative outlet North State Journal. Unlike other debutante balls, which usually benefit a charity or have some alignment with a nonprofit, the Terpsichorean Club appears to function only as a private social club. The organization did not reply when Indy reached out for comment. For a ritual limited to the very few, there are fewer than 200 debs presented each year at North Carolina's statewide ball. Debutante balls have an outsized presence in pop culture, from Bridgerton to, more locally, the North Carolina-based Amazon show, The Summer I Turned Pretty. Balls make good backdrops for narrative drama, which seems true in both fiction and life. They're also unabashedly about making a display of wealth and securing connections among the elite. Moore says, I know this is far from the biggest issue our state is facing today, but I think it's a marker that points to larger issues. It may be a small way, but this is one way that social and perhaps political power gets perpetuated in our state. In a state that ranks low in economic mobility, this seems to be one link in the chain of the good old boy network. Moore's conversations are cultural critiques, especially in an episode featuring Anna Shelton Ormond, a former debutante and fifth-year PhD student in sociology, who is writing her dissertation on debutante culture. But with or without a guest who wrote a thesis entitled Hegemonic Processes of Debutantes as Southern Social Royalty, as Shelton Ormond did, the podcast deftly peels back the layers of meaning around an event that, wonky as it seems from the outside, retains power both in the state and in the cultural imagination. Recovering Deb's cheeky title invokes therapy speak, the idea of recovery as a process by which one works through an addiction or traumatic event. It sets the tone for Moore's interviews, which are warm and intimate, like friends talking over tea. Recorded in Moore's home, Recovering Debs is also a family affair. Moore's husband, Bill Galen, acts as an editor, as does her sister, Carolyn Moore, and Moore's son, Max, wrote the theme music. Debuting is mostly a legacy venture, something families do together for generations, so it's fun that Moore's family is part of her recovery, too. Recovering in a traditional sense is returning to health after an illness and getting better. This is what the anti-racist movement asks of white people, too, to investigate their role in white supremacy and the ways they have benefited from it, and to do better. Recovering Debs offers an opportunity to follow along as some of the folks who most benefit from an exclusionary culture unpack the meaning of their participation. Moore says, I do think this is a time when many white women are waking up to white supremacy in its many forms. In the South, there is a long history of white women being especially idealized and protected. When the ball started, that was very much part of the culture. It's built into the whole Deb thing. When I ask Moore how long on average today's state debutantes spend preparing for their debut and what the total cost might be, she tallies up various expenses. The cost to attend the ball is $4,600, though that's just the start. Then come dresses, travel, hotel rooms. As she did the math, it struck me that the answer also isn't quantifiable. Moore's interviewees all paid other kinds of costs, too. Most trained their entire lives to become debutantes, born into it, like a family business. As I was listening to the third episode, my 14-year-old daughter barged into my office, interrupting me as kids do. She asked what I was doing, and off the cuff I said, I'm listening to a podcast about mothers making their daughters do things they don't want to do. She replied with the quick wit and urgency of a girl who has been creating a PowerPoint on why she should be allowed to get Snapchat, says, it should be about mothers letting their daughters do more things they want to do. The difference between what we want for our daughters and what they want can be a chasm. This is true whether or not you're a debutante. I've never been economically or culturally near debut culture, so participation was never asked of me, but I do remember feeling my parents' heavy disappointment when I refused to attend church youth group. Back then, I felt their longing for me to be more compliant. Now that I'm on the flip side of it, I understand that longing better. I've wanted my kids to like museums more. I've pressured them to play piano or go to dinner with people they'd rather not. I've asked them to grin and bear something, no doubt that I shouldn't. Parents make mistakes. Sometimes they realize it and recover, sometimes they don't, and their children must forge ahead with recovery on their own. As November looms on the horizon with abortion rights on the ballot, accompanied by a surge of conservative orthodoxy about women's roles, it's clear that the past is not quite so past. The complexity with which Moore and her guests consider the stakes of their participation in what may seem to be a frivolous event is a reminder that traditions have teeth, that the personal is also always political, that the strength behind the state deb ball goes beyond whatever small group of men is running it to include far-reaching systems of power and ideology. Because getting your daughter to debut by offering her a trip anywhere in the world, as one deb recounts on the podcast, isn't just a funny bribe. It's teaching her that free will has a price tag, and participation can be bought. It's telling her that upholding the status quo is more important than her feelings or morals. It's rebuilding a racist, classist system of exclusion, upheld by nimble bodies in white dresses, who might not have to Texas dip, but still have to contort themselves into positions they don't want to hold. In episode 2 of Recovering Debs, Lisa Grabarek describes the discomfort she felt every time she saw the two framed photos from her ball that hung in her parents' home. She tells her father later in life how and why these images disturb her, detailing the pain and shame she's held on to in the years since. She thinks he will surely remove the photos now that he knows. He doesn't. After her parents die, she takes the frames down, stomps the glass, tears the photos to pieces. It's an act of recovery. Now, an article about music, which I have saved in my folder since July 24th. And it's Charles Crossingham, the article written by Nick McGregor. begins. Arena ready is not a vibe that most two-person projects strive for, but during an October 2020 songwriting session, a digital guitar preset called Arena Ready worked magic for Stuart McLam and Charles Crossingham. McLam, the longtime frontman of Triangle indie favorite The Love Language, first met Crossingham, a Raleigh-based guitar aficionado, gear collector, and producer, in 2011. But they didn't grow close until late 2019, when Crossingham reconnected with McLam and offered to help produce the next Love Language album. Within a few months, they were going for broke, developing a new musical kinship and building Fancy Gap, an entirely new band, from the ground up. Crossingham tells IndieWeek, on the front porch of his mountain cabin in Fancy Gap, Virginia, where much of their self-titled debut album was written and recorded, "The Arena Ready preset was ballsier than we typically would have gone. But as a performer, Stu is built for it," Crossingham adds. "So Arena Ready became our mindset and our belief." That property overlooks the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains as they extend back towards the Piedmont, where both men live full-time. Out July the 26th on Ghost Choir Records, the band's own label, Fancy Gap explores universal themes, death, aging, life, love, and triumph, while channeling the joys of a back road drive, windows down, hair blowing in the Blue Ridge breeze. Crossingham first encountered the Fancy Gap area more than 15 years ago on a Christmas morning drive with his brother-in-law. He says it's like going into a different world. "Everybody told me I was crazy to buy this cabin, but it's brought a lot of joy to my life." McLam, who returned to his native Raleigh in March of 2020 after living for a few years in Los Angeles, heard plenty about the cabin. He laughs, "I was intrigued, but also a little skeptical. But with pandemic lockdowns in force, the serenity proved inspiring." McLam says it's always hard to streamline creativity and tap into the weird, mysterious place that songs come from. But Charles had a good inclination this place would work. There's good energy here. The two friends bonded over 90s radio rock and 98.1 WBRF, a classic country station out of Galax, Virginia. The rafter-reaching choruses and crowd-pleasing guitar licks inspired them to chase their own bombastic sound. Recorded on Crossingham's Quad 8 rack unit, a high-end 1960s console rescued from the ashes of a famous Seattle studio and lovingly rebuilt by Jonathan Whitley, a Carrboro-based friend of both men. Since the Quad 8s were portable, they could transport them up to Fancy Gap and capture their mountain magic, rather than just playing in what McLam calls a sterile live room. Over the next 2 years, the duo dedicated themselves to crafting songs and jamming at the cabin. Crossingham on guitar, McLam on drums and vocals. The former would toss out cheeseburgers, simple melodic ideas, song titles, or opening lines to the latter, who says he often found himself nailing lead vocals on the first or second take. McLam says it reminded me of being a kid again, like playing in the garage with my brother just for fun. It's a luxury you have when you're younger, without as many responsibilities. That freed the duo to dream big. McLam envisioned a Neil Young-inspired rock record, while Crossingham embraced the challenge of taming his friend's wild Mustang energy. Cunningham said it was a leap of faith, figuring out how to make a big-ass recording by ourselves. McLam concurs. Charles would say, "Go big and let me go wild." Then we'd rein it in and drive it home together. The final results on Fancy Gap are polished and propulsive, with McLam's soaring vocals and timeless pop timbre laid atop Crossingham's sonic expertise. The band channels disparate influences, Counting Crows and the Lemonheads, Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Tom Petty, Travis Tritt, while staying true to their own ambitions. Lead singles How to Dance and Little Heart Racer are unabashed bangers. The latter features McLam singing in the deepest southern drawl of his career, playing homage to the back roads down in Carroll County, where the summers are as slow as they should be. It's pure country radio catnip, which just 5 years ago might have felt disorienting. McLam laughs, "The song came out of nowhere. It wasn't like, let's sit down and write a big country ballad. But I'm a funny chameleon. I love pop music." That love is evident on Strawberry Moon, which features gentle cascading pianos and guest vocals from indie rock hero Sharon Van Etten, whom McLam has known for years. His original idea was a synth-pop version, but after workshopping it with Crossingham and tracking Van Etten's vocals during her most recent North Carolina tour, they excavated a witchier, more Fleetwood Mac meets War on Drugs vibe. Other wistful moments abound. The misty mornings that inspired Whispering Winds and the mountain sunsets that Crossingham and McLam chase all over the record. One even appears on the cover of Fancy Gap. Crossingham says that place changes all day. You can do nothing and feel productive because, well, you watch the sky change. Melancholic reflection informs Magnolias as well. Written about the passing of Crossingham's friend, McLam handles it with the care of his tender falsetto. Meanwhile, the moody, minor key, sweet time scans as Dark California Noir, an epic song McLam half-jokingly considered pitching to Adele. Again, those ambitions make perfect sense, especially on 40,000 Miles, which features two scorching guitar solos, recorded with that arena-ready preset, that McLam and Crossingham consider a rock and roll call and response. Meanwhile, Diamond Cutter is sonically complex, a slinky slice of cowboy goth that layers guitar riffs and gentle castanets over heart-wrenching lyrics. It's the strongest contender to make best of playlists and endure as an all-time favorite, a la early The Love Language classics Lalita and Heart to Tell. To flesh out the song, they dialed up an all-star cast: keyboardist Rami Jaffe, Foo Fighters, session guitarist Will McFarlane, Bonnie Raitt and Etta James, and pedal steel John Graboff, Willie Nelson, Norah Jones. All added licks so strong they twinkle in the sky of each song, Crossingham marvels. Grammy-winning engineer Craig Alvin cemented the sonic excellence, mixing the record at his famed Muscle Shoals studios while Jeff Lifton mastered it in Boston. Fancy Gap's current live band, Robert Sledge, Nick Baglio, Steve Howell, and Mark Simonson, has also rounded into form. Crossingham says these guys believe in the record, which has introduced a new responsibility for us. Their dreams are fusing into our dreams. A collective feeling is a special part of Fancy Gap. For McLam, it's a huge step forward. Yes, he's still wringing emotion out of every lyric, writing hook-laden songs that tackle heartbreak, loss, and the enduring weight of existence, but now he's doing from a fresh, collaborative perspective. He says, "When Charles and I met in 2011, I was in a weirder place, real protective, maybe too much." Fast forward to 2020, when he realized how invested Crossingham was in his success. Charles has this thing where he doesn't care about who's invited to the party. He sees a lot of light in different kinds of people. Fancy Gap's light is shining bright. The album's first three singles have accumulated nearly 100,000 streams on Spotify with listeners in 140 countries. A May show at the Poor House in Raleigh sold about 40 tickets. Another one in June packed the house with approximately 270. Next up, a July 27th album release show at Local 506 in Chapel Hill, followed by further tour dates and sustained growth. Crossingham says, "We didn't just spend 4 years making the record. We learned how to be a team." McClam believes Fancy Gap can be huge while focusing on enjoying the ride. "Our intention is rooted in this not becoming a chore. If you take care of the music and create something good, it rewards you in its own way. You can have peace." With that peace has come a deeper reflection on life, art, and creativity. Cunningham muses, "Stu is a great leader who also never leads, you know. You're dancing with Stu. He's not saying, 'Come on, this way.' It's, 'Where are we going together?' He makes everyone feel like family. The brotherhood of the experience started mattering more than previous stories of our lives. That's my favorite part of this record." Crossingham remembers McClam despairing in 2020 when the pandemic ended so much. "Stu kept bringing up the scene. 'The scene's dead, man.' And I was like, 'What scene? Whatever was before is no longer. We're going to create the next scene together." I have time to offer a little précis of a short article anyway about downtown Durham, where Loco Shop, an evolution of the popsicle joint Loco Pop, is going to open in downtown Durham at 600 Foster Street in the space previously occupied by Altered Image Hair Designers. It's their second location in downtown Durham coming up this fall. Billed as a treats cafe and market rolled into one, Loco Shop will carry just about everything the flagship Loco Pops does, according to owner Summer Bricknell, including house-made popsicles, yum, ice cream, sweet and savory pies, as well as local and gourmet pantry items, prepared meals, beer and wine, greeting cards, and knickknacks. Well, I'm, of course, thinking about rolling over to Durham in this 100-degree heat, but I think the theme music is telling me to go home instead. John Federson for North Carolina Reading Service, wishing you farewell, and we'll be back next week with Indie Week.